I think we're all set to get going this morning. Thank you for coming out on this very cold and chilly January morning to Developmental Disability Grand Rounds. I think we should all get extra cups of tea or coffee or stickers for being here on this cold day. For those of you who have been here before, you know the routine in terms of signing in if you want to get continuing medical education credits or APA credits. If you would like to get credits, you do need to fill out this form, okay? And all of you, please, are asked to fill out this evaluation form because it really helps us as we develop and design this series. So it is my absolute pleasure to introduce to you this morning Dr. Amy Needham. And Amy, how long ago was it that we recruited you from Duke? Is it a year?
Yeah, about a year.
About a year ago, we recruited her from Duke. And Amy has a fascinating line of work looking at infant touch, right, and infant grasp. And I remember when Amy was being recruited during one of the visits, I learned about something called the sticky mitten method. And I thought, what on earth is that? And I don't know if you're going to talk about sticky mitten today, so I won't take your punchline. But her talk this morning should be absolutely fascinating because it dovetails with an area of passion that I think Amy and others in this room have had for some time in the area of visual impairment. So, Amy, I'm looking forward to learning more about your work, and welcome.
Thanks, Elizabeth, and thanks for inviting me. I'm maybe one of your newer members here, and I'm really excited to get more involved in what's going on here. So I see this as Elizabeth said, a good first step in the right direction in that regard. And although I normally would love to have questions as I go, I've been told by the powers that be that because of the video situation, it's better to hold those towards the end so we can get everything on video and on audio in particular. And also, if it starts to become difficult to hear me, please let me know. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about today is sort of a something that I've been interested in for quite a while, but is kind of a new thing for me in terms of my actual data collection and research specific research investigations, and that has to do with motor development in visually impaired children. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit to begin with about some general things having to do with motor development in typically developing kids, and I'm going to then go on to talk about some sort of ideas that we had in this regard and sort of how we got involved in this idea, these kinds of ideas in the first place. Show you a little bit of data, both from typically developing babies and also some teasers on some data that we have in visually impaired infants, and tell you sort of towards the end about our goals going forward and what we're really hoping to do in terms of setting up an intervention to help children with visual impairment get involved in the physical world, the world of objects, that they that any child needs to learn a lot about as early as we can to help that learning go forward in as efficient way as possible. Okay, so that's the plan for the talk, and so what I'm gonna start here is to tell you a little bit about what people used to think about motor development and how that has changed and why. So the traditional view of motor development, which probably many of you learned about as a historical thing, Arnold Gazelle and Myrtle McGraw and those folks back in the 1930s and 1940s, had, Gazelle in particular, had this very strong kind of dogmatic view of motor development as consisting of this very one-way kind of unilateral direction here, that the brain is the thing that controlled movement of the body. And so this arrow going, a very large kind of thick arrow going in one direction is very intentional here, that you don't have any sort of bidirectionality. Of course, you know, probably the 1940s were not the heyday of bidirectionality in general, but you've got the brain that is the cause of and really the sole determiner for body movement. And so observing motor development is akin to observing brain development, really, from Gazelle's perspective. And if you look at these books that came out of the 1930s, that have his, you know, stunning kind of photographic records that come from his movies that he took of babies in that big kind of igloo dome kind of thing that he used to observe kids. You can see these frameworks that he has, these sets of pictures that he entitles Mental Development in Children. And these are photos of them doing things. This is basically what we would call now motor development or development of prehension or development of posture, but he entitled that Mental Development. So that's an indication of how firmly he believed, how much this was just a part of how he thought, that the movement of the body was produced by the brain, and so we could learn about brain development by looking at the body and how it moved and how that changed over time. But really, this view has changed dramatically, and a more contemporary view is one that does not deny that the brain is involved in moving the body, obviously, but also looks at all of these other things, includes all sorts of things like the biomechanics, how the different parts of the limbs influence the movement that can happen, how the motivation of the child influences how the body moves, things like muscle strength, context, and various extraneous factors, you know, so that's, how's that for a catch-all category there? All of these things contribute to, and probably other things that I haven't listed, contribute to the movement of the body. And so looking at brain is one, you know, relatively small part of understanding how the body moves, and because all of these things contribute. And so, you know, what's a real challenge here in looking at developmental change in motor abilities is to sort of sift through all of these possible influences to figure out which ones are really active at any point in time. And obviously, there could be different influences at different points in time in development. And so, on the one hand, people studying motor development kind of in early life have it easy because their phenomenon of interest is right there and visible for everyone to see. It's easy to observe, relatively, compared to something like cognition, let's say. But to try to think about how to sort all these things out is a really complicated thing. And so, you know, it's sort of made the task of looking at and understanding motor development much more difficult than it used to be when, you know, the world of gazelle thought all you had to do was watch and that was what you needed to know. And most importantly, and this is going to be important for other things that I'm going to say later today, and that is that the central nervous system is not calling all the shots, all right? So it's not like we've got this clear, unidirectional thing going on here. There is a lot of bidirectionality and a lot of malleability and change that can happen that doesn't really have to do with the brain per se. And so I want to tell you about an example that's one of my favorites that doesn't really have so much to do with reaching, which is what I'm going to be talking more about later, but it's such a compelling story that I felt like I had to tell it. And that is this disappearing reflex, which some of you may have heard about before. There are lots of reflexes that are thought to disappear early in development, and so one wonders whether a similar kind of story could be unearthed for any number of these reflexes that we know about. But the newborn stepping reflex is one that has been studied a fair amount in motor development from kind of a psychological perspective. And one thing we know for sure about this reflex is that you can get newborn infants to show it, and you can't get like 5 or 6 month old infants to show it, at least under typical conditions where you hold the baby under its arms and you sort of drag its feet along a flat surface. So if you do that for a newborn baby, what you get are these beautiful alternating steps that have a very specific biomechanical signature to them. So newborns do it, then, you know, older babies don't do it, and then obviously around a year or 14 months of age, children start to walk on their own. And so that same kind of alternating stepping with that same kind of biomechanical signature reappears magically. And so why would this be the case? Well, back in the day when we thought that everything about how the body moved was controlled by the brain, explanations came to the fore, like maybe early on the stepping reflex is under brainstem control, and then later on when the cortex becomes more hooked up and really fully functioning, then it takes over, and this somehow inhibits that reflex that was initially present and visible because of the brainstem activity. So that's one possibility. And, you know, other than it being just kind of a just-so story and the fact that we know that the cortex isn't fully hooked up early in life, you know, as a newborn anyway, that there isn't a whole bunch of evidence for or against this perspective until Esther Thalen, who unfortunately is no longer with us, made a very important observation, and that was that she noticed that at an age when, 5, 6, 7 months of age, when babies don't do the stepping reflex, they do something else, and that is that they, when they're laying on their backs, they do kicking, lots and lots of kicking. And this, when you videotape it and you get the biomechanical measures for that, what she found is that this is really biomechanically identical to the stepping that they'll do later as one-year-olds or one-and-a-half-year-olds. All right, so she thought, that's an interesting thing. If all of what the body is doing is completely provided by this motor program in the central nervous system, why would the movements be so different, whether depending on the position that the child is in? So if the child's on its back, they do stepping-like behavior. If they're held upright, they don't. You know, so why would that be? Why would the brain? Does the brain have some sort of position detector that turns some things on and other things off? It just didn't make sense. And so what she ended up finding, and I'm making a long story very short here, is that they do, 5 and 6 and 7 month old babies do show this stepping behavior if you put them in a different kind of context. So if you do something like put them on a treadmill, and so this photograph shows a baby all decked out in biomechanical markers and stuff here, with a little treadmill here, and you see that when the baby is supported on the treadmill, so that the stepping is sort of kind of enabled by the treadmill, those steps that the baby produces are not random, weird, hopping, kind of sideways gait things, but they're very organized, biomechanically beautiful-looking steps that they do. Likewise, if you put a baby's legs, fat little legs, in water, what you see is a similar sort of thing. So this baby has his legs down in the water, and what you see is stepping, alternating stepping, that again, if you had the biomechanical markers on him, you'd see the same kind of movements of the top part of the leg and the bottom part of the leg. Obviously, this is a little different because it's not on a surface, but still, what you see is this alternating movement. And if you have the child in these different kinds of contexts, what you see is stepping behavior when you don't see it in a normal, just sort of standing up, having to make those movements yourself. And so what she realized then is that these stepping behaviors disappear because their legs are too fat and their muscles aren't strong enough yet to move those fat, chubby legs in the way they need to produce those nice, beautiful steps. So if they get the help from the treadmill or if their legs are made very buoyant in the water, they do step. And so also in other studies, she showed that infants who normally do walk, so if you look at 14, 15-month-old infants who are pretty, you know, not perfectly great on their feet, but they do walk typically at that point, if you put weights on their legs, they stop producing those steps also. So it's a matter of how heavy the leg is and how strong the muscles are. And it's not a matter of a central nervous system brain program somehow controlling that behavior. All right, so back to this contemporary view I was telling you about that really focuses on contextual factors. What you see is that body movement is, in some sense, totally controlled by, or very much controlled by, the display of this behavior is all about whether the legs are too fat before they're strong enough. People have also found things like babies who have skinny legs tend to walk earlier than babies who have fat legs. And so there's lots of support now for this kind of approach, this kind of perspective. Okay, so that's one story that I enjoy because I think it's a very clever kind of observation for Thalen to have made. But there's another story that I think is just as interesting and compelling and has to do with infants who are visually impaired. And what we see here is that the development of manual behavior, so movement of the arms in a goal-directed fashion, is very different in infants with visual impairment compared to sighted infants. So if you look at the typical motor milestones for typically developing kids, what you see is they're beginning to reach independently and accurately, successfully for objects around 5 months of age or so. And again, obviously this depends on all sorts of things, like I've just given you all sorts of reasons to believe, well, why would you say 5 months? You know, is that a, you know, etched in stone kind of thing? Well, no, it's not. But on average, 5 months is about the time. But in infants who are visually impaired, 5 months is nowhere near where they begin to interact with objects around them. And there's all sorts of reasons why this might be true. And I'll get to some of those. What you see in studies, numerous studies that have been done on this, actually there aren't, this is almost all of them that have been done. I say numerous, there are several listed here, including the beautiful work of Deborah Hatton in the audience here. But if you look at kids who are visually impaired, they don't engage in reaching behavior for objects, even sounding objects. They don't engage in sort of manipulating and sort of investigating objects with their hands very much until much later. And that's true even if they have no known motor impairment. So even if you get kids who, as far as we know, their only disability is visual impairment, this motor consequence is still seen. All right, so this is a really interesting phenomenon, I think, because it points to the possibility that here we've got this behavior that we think is all etched in stone. We have this nice motor milestone chart, et cetera. But what we see is that in these kids who really, as far as anybody would have predicted maybe, ought to be showing typical milestones for motor development, they're really not. And so this is another kind of non-central nervous system influence on the display of motor development, I think, just like the disappearing reflexes. All right, so what we see here is some evidence then that visual input is really important for motivating this motor development in kids, all right? And so this probably doesn't come as a big surprise for many of you, but from the sort of the world of typical development in psychology, people are like, oh, you mean there are things that ought to affect motor development other than just whether the nervous system is okay? And I'm like, yeah, there really are. So what we see then are two pieces of evidence in favor of this. And again, there's lots of pieces of evidence, but I'm going to talk about two, one based on deprivation and one on enrichment. So as I've already signaled then, studies like the Brambring study of 2007, as well as Ann Bigelow's work from many years ago now, what we see is that on average, children who are severely visually impaired begin reaching for sounding objects and manually exploring these objects at least 5 months later than infants who are sighted. All right, so it's a big delay. It's not just a couple few weeks. Then on the other side of it, from an enrichment perspective, what I'd like to offer up as an interesting kind of comparison point is some work that we've done looking at typically developing infants and giving them increased opportunity to engage in interactions with objects. All right, so what I sort of think this is kind of like the flip side of what happens for infants who are visually impaired and don't get a lot of input from their interactions with objects and, in fact, are not engaging in those interactions. And so what we've done is to look at typically developing infants and sort of boost up, enrich their ability, their opportunity to look at these kinds of, to sort of collect this kind of data for themselves. And I want to show you how we do that. So Elizabeth made mention at the beginning of this sticky mittens stuff that we've worked on. And so what I'm going to show you here is video from an infant who is sighted, typically developing, as far as we know. She's 2 months, 27 days at the time this video was taken. And at that time, she had had already about 2 weeks of training with these mittens that we sent home with her dad. And these mittens are just sort of typical baby mittens. You'll see them in the video. And they have Velcro, the soft side of Velcro, on the palms of the mittens. And what we do then is we ask parents to sit at a table with their baby in their lap so that they can provide postural support for their baby, and to put toys on the table in front of the baby that have Velcro on the edges, the corresponding side of Velcro on the edges of the toys. And so the toys are lightweight so that they can be picked up easily by the very low-tech technology of Velcro. So all the baby has to do is sort of swipe near the toy, which they're motorically capable of at that point in development, and they end up picking the toy up and they can move it through their visual field. And so what we find in our training is that we start with babies who are about 2 months, 15 days on average, and babies that age, usually if we give them a couple of examples of how just sort of move their hand over to the toy, stick the toy to their hand, and then sort of wiggle their hand around a little bit so they can see that the toy is sticking to their mitten, we only have to do that once or twice before they kind of get the idea and they start to move their hands sort of swatting near the toys and getting some success. All right, so here I'm going to show you this baby. Who, as I said, has already been trained some for. She gets daily exposure to this. And one of the things you can notice is that she's looking a lot at the toys, and her behavior with her hands really. To us, seems to indicate intention on her part. She's not just accidentally bumping into the toys, but she's sort of winding up, she's looking at the toy, and she's getting her hand to the toy. She's doing a bunch of other stuff, too, and she doesn't always contact the toy when she's looking at it, but she also does a fair amount of, and this isn't something we see in every kid, but she uses one toy to kind of hit another toy. I think she does. I thought she did that. And so one thing that's striking to us in looking at videos of babies who've had this kind of experience and those who haven't is that the babies who have had this experience, they're looking at the toys a whole lot more than babies who haven't. And so that's intriguing to us. We don't know exactly what all that means other than the fact that it might help them be learning stuff about these toys, which is cool from our perspective. So what I'm going to tell you about briefly here is a study that we did in which we compared the responses in a very simple sort of visual and tactile exploration task of three groups, actually, I guess it was four, well, no, three groups of babies. One of them received this kind of active training that I just described, where they had the toys at home and the mittens for about 2 weeks. And so from about 10 to 14 days, they got about 10 minutes of experience of the kind that you just saw, where they're sitting at a table, their toys in front of them, they get the opportunity to interact with those toys. There's no demand that they spend any amount of time actually interacting. They just have that opportunity to do that. And the training can begin as young as 2 months, 15 days, and it goes on for about 2 weeks. And at the endpoint testing that I'll tell you about, they were at most 3 months, 15 days. So that's our active training group. And our passive training group was as similar to that group as we could make it, except we took out their ability to actually move the toys around using those sticky mittens. So they were about the same age. They had the daily sessions. They involved the same toys. They wore mittens, but the mittens didn't stick to the toys. And what we had was a little sort of routine that we taught the parents that involved moving the toy around in a lot of the same ways that the infants who are using the sticky mittens do spontaneously on their own. So there's a lot of side-to-side movement, up and down movement, touching the mittens with the toys, tapping the toys on the table. So the parents did this sort of dance with the objects for the babies, and they brought those objects to their attention in, you know, as similar a way as we could muster to the active training group. So that was the passive training group. And then we had, I'm just going to be sort of talking about a single control group here that received no training prior to testing, and we just brought them in at an age that was as close to the trained groups as we could get. And we tested with a whole bunch of tasks, actually, but what I'm going to tell you about today is a looking, reaching, grasping task that was consisting of four 30-second segments that involved a rattle here that was placed on a table. So the baby was sitting at a table in our lab or at home. We did some testing at home in between the two lab sessions also. The lab sessions were 2 weeks apart, as I mentioned. And so the toy was initially definitely beyond the infant's reach, kind of, you know, far from their hands, but still reachable, very close to their hands, so that all they'd have to do is sort of move over just a matter of a centimeter or two to get their hand to the toy. And then we actually placed the toy in their hand for the last 30 seconds. So each of these bouts was about 30 seconds long. If at any point the child grasped the toy, so let's say they grasped it in this far condition, which was very rare, we would still let them do sort of the equivalent of this 30 seconds and that 30 seconds holding the toy. But we didn't like rip it out of their hand and then put it in the close position after that. All right. So our goal was to get them to explore it. And initially, they could do so only visually. Eventually, they could do so visually, manually, orally, however they wanted to. And then we were curious about how these groups might differ in how they responded in these far and close conditions where they'd have to take a little bit of the initiative to get the toy themselves. And so what you see here is a bunch of graphs. I'm sorry that it's as crowded as it is. But for now, just look at this top graph here. And what this plots here is the percent of the duration of that 30-second segment when the infants were looking at the toy when it was beyond reach. So when it was in this beyond the far condition here and it was absolutely too far for them to reach, what you see across the x-axis here is the first lab visit, the second lab visit, which are separated by about 2 weeks, and then we've got these four home visits in which my graduate student, Klaus Libertus, one of the most patient men on the face of this earth, went to all of these babies' homes and visited them and did this assessment of looking and reaching. And so the different lines here, the solid line here is the active training group, the dotted line is the passive training group, and then the little triangle here at the end that's hard to see is the no training group. So what you see in this top graph is that the babies who are in the passive training group did much more looking at the toy when it was beyond reach. So when it was certainly too far for them to grasp, the babies who are in the passive training group did significantly more looking at that toy than the babies in the active training group. And the untrained group is right between the two at the second lab visit. So they only got the second lab visit testing. And so the way we interpret this, at least one possibility that we'd like to raise, is that the active training of actually getting the objects on your hands and moving them around allows these young babies to get a better sense of when an object is actually within their grasp and when it's not. So obviously, they're only getting 10 minutes of exposure to the mittens training, but of course, we don't prevent them from interacting with toys when they're not wearing the mittens, and so we're thinking that this experience that they're getting on a daily basis might motivate them to interact with objects more just using their hands at other times of day when we're not doing the training. And this might give them the opportunity to, they could also learn relevant things within the training episode as well. You know, how far is something away from me? You know, it looks about this big or it looks about this far. This is the distance between me and that object. And if I swing my hand out and towards that object, I'm either successful or I'm not in making contact with it. All right, so that's the kind of experience we think is probably useful here. And so these babies who are getting the active experience realize the object is too far for them to get, might as well not bother getting too excited about this toy just yet, and so they show less looking at it than the babies who have the passive training. One might also argue, and I wouldn't argue against this, that in the passive training group, we're basically training these babies up to look at toys. It's like parents are going, look at this toy, look at this toy, you know? And so it might be that they're getting more used to just looking at toys, having their attention brought to toys. And so one might just say, well, this is kind of what you've trained them to do, and so why be surprised that they're doing it more? That is certainly a possibility as well. The second graph here shows reaching and grasping when the toy is close. And so this is, we've combined these two, the far and close condition here. In both cases, the toy is within reach. They can potentially get it. And so what you see here on the y-axis is percent of the 60 seconds of both of those trials mixed together that the infants are reaching towards the toy and eventually contacting it or grasping the toy, actually, when the toy is in one of those two positions. And so what we see here is that over between lab visit one and lab visit two and in the home visits also, we see a steady increase in the active training group and a much more modest increase in the passive training group. All right, so it's not like these babies are never going for the toy, never succeeding in getting the toy. It's just that they're doing so quite a bit less than the active training group do. And then our untrained group is here right on top of the passive training group. This bottom graph here shows the bouts of looking at the toy while the babies were holding it. So this is just in, this is just in this last part of the session where the toy was in their hand, placed in their hand for them. And what you see here is the number of looking episodes. So the looking at the toy, looking away, looking at the toy, looking away, each of those looking at the toy separated by the looking away would be one bout. And what you see then in the bar graph is the number of these bouts, and this far, the leftmost set of bars is the active training group, the passive training group, and no training. The clear bars are after training, and the dark bars are before training. And so what you see in the active training group is that they've increased the number of bouts of looking at the toy while they're holding it, and the passive training group didn't. And the no training group shows kind of an intermediate level there. What's interesting about this for us is based on other findings from our lab as well as findings from the lab of Philippe Rochat and other people, what is seen is that more sophisticated exploration strategies involve more kind of back and forth, more switching between exploration in different modalities. And so what Rochat finds is that between 2 and 5 months of age, children are doing much more switching back and forth between looking and mouthing when there's an object in their hand that they're exploring. And he sees this as a more sophisticated, more multimodal way of getting information out of a toy. When it's in your mouth, you might feel a certain kind of characteristic, and then you take the toy out and you see what that characteristic looked like. Or you can. That's an opportunity you have. You may not be doing that on purpose if you're a 3-month-old infant, but you might be. And so we think this is possible, possibly what these actively trained infants are doing more of is more of this multimodal kind of exploration. And we're still doing more coding to see whether that is borne out when we look at other kinds of measures in our data. But we have seen a relation between more switching in their object exploration and better performance in things like determining where one object ends and another begins in a simple visual object segregation task. So we think that there is learning going on here based on some of our other work when babies are doing this object exploration. Okay, so these are some of our findings showing that, indeed, if babies are given this opportunity that we give them to observe the consequences of their actions when they can actually move an object around at a time in life when they normally couldn't do that on their own, what we see is an increase in reaching and grasping compared to infants who are not given that opportunity. All right, and so, and based on other measures from this same data set, we see earlier reaching in these infants who are given this 2 weeks of sticky mittens experience. And so we think that one possibility anyway, based on our data, that learning to reach is facilitated by not just vision, period, but a specific thing that you're able to see when you're looking, and that is looking at what happens when you are flailing about or moving your arms around like young babies do. And, you know, things happen. You run your hands into objects and they move away, for example. So I'll get to that in more detail in a second here, but I wanted to also mention two other things. So I'm not saying, lest you be concerned that we're thinking that this is the only thing that contributes to babies beginning to reach. This certainly isn't true. This might be the most important thing for infants who are visually impaired, because we think that two other very likely pieces of information or sources of information that are useful for beginning to reach for typically developing infants are things like things that infants who are visually impaired really don't have much access to. And these are things like seeing objects that look really cool. They might be silent, but they might look really neat, and they might be attractive. They might draw infants' hands almost like a magnet, you know. So there might be some objects that are just so attractive and so appealing that babies want to get them just by virtue of how interesting they look. And, of course, what looks interesting to a baby might be really different than what looks interesting to us, of course. And then another thing that might play a role here for infants who are sighted is that they see other people reaching for things, and they may be motivated to imitate what other people do. And so they obviously, a lot of this behavior is silent behavior. You see somebody, you know, pick up their cup, you see somebody adjust a microphone, you see somebody pick up a piece of paper. Most of these actions are pretty quiet and don't have obvious auditory, you know, recognizable auditory signatures to them. And so I really feel like a lot of these kinds of observations are just not going to be available for infants who are visually impaired. And in fact, these kinds of observations that are available for sighted infants are not going to be so available for them either under typical circumstances. And so what we're really trying to do now is to create observations for infants who are visually impaired that they have access to, basically. Okay, so I'm going to get back to that, but I wanted to, in order to kind of get you on, going to skip over some of this. I'm sorry, I've been going a little more slowly than I meant to. So I wanted to tell you just a couple of key pieces of information about what happens just in typical development in terms of moving arms and hands around early in development, and in particularly in the newborn period. We know that even in utero, there's a lot of arm movement that happens. Fetuses reach out and touch the uterine wall. Sometimes fetuses bring the hand to the mouth. And one of the really cool things, and this is relevant for part of our intervention, is that newborn infants will work to keep their hands in view. And so this is a really bizarre looking picture, I realize, but it's a drawing that comes from a paper by Audrey Vandermeer. And what this shows is a newborn baby who's laying on her back, and the baby's in the dark. And what this white thing here is a beam of light. And so what they've done is to set up this very kind of bizarre situation in which mostly the baby's in the dark, but there is this very specific place where there is a beam of light kind of over the head of the baby. So the baby's here, the beam of light is coming like over the baby's head or over their arms. And what you find is that the babies will tend to move their hand into that beam of light so that their hand is visible. And she also finds things like as the hand approaches the beam of light, it slows down. And like, how cool is that? That's just the neatest thing ever, right? So they seem to really be somewhat on purpose moving their hands to places where they can see them. And she shows this not only in this situation, but also in other experimental situations where babies have to work to keep their hands in view, and they do that. So one of the things that I think is really cool about this is that we can all kind of get a sense just proprioceptively of where our hands are in space, but it might be that early in life we're motivated to kind of seek for ourselves some redundant information about where our hand is in space. And so there might be some sort of help that the system needs to kind of figure out and to do really accurate coding of where the hand is in space. And so proprioception is good. Maybe early on it typically gets some help from vision so that the baby knows where the hand is when it feels the hand in this position or that position. Okay? There's also this thing called pre-reaching that happens very early in life. Babies are very kind of agitated and their hands flop around when they're looking at a toy, even as newborns. It's not entirely clear how that relates to later successful reaching. And there's also been some interesting observations done by Brambring and his colleagues looking at the hand behaviors and positions of young children who are visually impaired. Interestingly, what you see is that the typical kind of moving from clenched fists of the newborn to open hands that typically happens around 3 months of age, this happens in infants who are visually impaired as well as infants who are sighted. But then after that, the changes that seem to occur in typically in sighted infants don't seem to happen for visually impaired. So our question here is that, you know, as I said, we're trying to come up with a way to give infants who are visually impaired the same kinds of experiences about their own actions and how those have certain consequences in the physical world that they don't easily get on their own. So as I was saying before, typically developing and sighted infants will see an object move after they have accidental contact with it. And you can see this on YouTube if you search for babies who in infant gyms. There's lots of evidence of babies who flap around and they move things, and parents are really excited about that, and they put those videos on YouTube. So we think it's very, very likely that infants who are visually impaired are not having these kinds of experiences like a sighted baby would have in an infant gym where they are laying there and they see the objects move based on their own flapping of their arms. It's also the case, as Brambring has pointed out, that their experience of the world is less unified and less cohesive. So for his example was you hear, a lot of objects are silent, first of all, and also a lot of objects that are sounding are not necessarily close to you. So a bird that you hear chirping is not something you can touch, even though you hear the sound very, very clearly. So our intervention that we're working on here should provide experiences with auditory consequences of their actions. So just in a very kind of straightforward sensory substitution kind of way, that's what we're looking at. We do have a little bit of preliminary data with one infant who is severely visually impaired. She received sticky mittens training with sounding objects, and she received that between 3 and 4 months of age. What we found, and I'm sorry, I'm not going to have time to go through this really carefully with you, but what we found is that she was searching for sounding objects when we tested her at 6.5 months of age. We provided an object, a sounding object for her that was continuously sounding. It was a little object that was playing a little sound, a song, sorry. So it wasn't a rattle, but rather something that was continuously sounding. And what we see here in these graphs is that over the period of time where we were testing her, providing the object, she did, in a matter of seconds, start searching through space for the object, moving her hand in a sort of a circular fashion. And she did, over the period of 5 trials that we tested her, she ended up making contact with that toy within about 2 seconds. All right, so, and the only difference between these two graphs is we started out on the right-hand side and then we moved to the left-hand side of her body in presenting this object. So we think that having this experience with the sticky mittens, with sounding objects, being able to move these objects around and having the objects sounding in ways around her head so she could hear how her movements, hear the consequences of those actions were important for her, potentially anyway. We don't have a good comparison group just yet. So then we took the mittens off and we did the same thing. We looked at the latency of her touch to the toy and we found that she contacted the toy even without the mittens on very quickly. I don't know what we're doing here with time. I know we started a little bit late, but I know that also I was supposed to stop like 5 minutes ago. I'm sorry about that. But let me just tell you very quickly about our intervention and the components of it that we're looking at. So one of the things we're doing is we've created some bracelets that have little mini metronomes in them. And these little metronomes are meant to like sit in your ear if you're a musician, but they're actually kind of loud, and there are warnings on the labels telling you not to use it for very long, which worries me for musicians who might be using these. But for us, they're great because they can go in a bracelet, and we're thinking that this could provide that same experience that was in the Vandermeer study, where they're hearing the clicking, and we're not presenting an object or anything, but we're just giving them experience with their hands making sound at different, as they move their hands around. We're also going to be encouraging them to investigate near space with their hands by giving them wind chime-like objects that are very close to them so that as they begin to move their hands around and as we encourage them to move their hands, they can hear the consequences of that. We're going to be giving them experience with an electric kiddie piano that has really wide keys and encourage them to reach out and touch the keys to hear the sounds. And then we're also going to be giving them the sticky mittens with sounding objects so that they can get that same kind of reaching out, successfully getting an object and moving it around. And so as I've described, I hope I've done a reasonable job of describing what we're hoping to do. We're hoping to draw them into the world of objects sooner, these infants who typically don't get involved in the world of objects as soon as they could.
And we're thinking this is going to give them learning opportunities. And then in a more theoretical vein here, we're interested in this issue of why infants begin reaching for objects, whether they're infants who are visually impaired or sighted infants. And so we see these two lines of work as being very integrally related to each other, and that questions of motivation, why reaching happens, are receiving renewed attention, which we think is really important. And just as a parting note, I'd like you to encourage that you to realize and to remember, I guess I should say, I know you all realize this, but that failures of behavior early on are not necessarily a result of a lack of physical ability. And I want to thank Klaus with his own little baby who was just recently born and my sources of funding, and thank you for your attention. And I'm sorry, I went over.
So you mentioned that babies in their early stages like to be able to see their hands. So does that mean that swaddling is not a good idea?
Well, I'd be hesitant to take a strong stand on that. I mean, I think swaddling is really good for babies who have a hard time calming themselves, and it's not like they have to see their hands all the time. Especially for little babies, they're awake and alert for relatively brief periods of time during the day. So I wouldn't say that there's anything bad about swaddling. I think that you shouldn't prevent your baby when it's awake and alert from seeing their hands if it doesn't make them fussy and upset to be unswaddled. So I guess I would encourage, sort of going with the baby's lead in that regard. Yeah, Dan?
You mentioned earlier on that babies, when they're supine, they do a lot of kicking and so on. And, some people like Carolyn Rovey Collier have looked at that, where they tie a rope or to a mobile and so on, and show that babies will perform in that regard. I wonder if some of the things that you're doing with sound might work well if you hook the things up to babies' feet instead of their hands. Because during that period, there's probably a period when they're not reaching, but they are doing that sort of kicking.
Yeah, I feel like there, I know there was some study by Michael Lewis and some of his colleagues from quite a while ago where he did sort of a Rovey Collier kind of manipulation where he tied a string to the baby's hands and allowed them to, something about a video, a slide projector or something becoming more or less in focus depending on what the baby's hand did, I think, or turning on, maybe it might have been that the movement of their arm turned something on. I don't know. I mean, I feel like in general, like, aren't the arms kind of ahead of the legs in terms of just sort of cephalocaudal directions of development and stuff like that? I mean, they might be kicking, but are they doing... Okay, so now's when I'll admit that we did try to do a sticky booties study where we had booties on babies. And what became clear to us, like, we were really into the challenge of seeing whether we could get this to work and whether we could figure out if the, create a situation where the babies weren't just kicking to get the toy. And we realized, a toy, when it's stuck to your foot, does not have the same opportunities for exploration as it does when it's strapped to your hand, because it's kind of far away from your face. And unless you have them on their backs and they can kind of bring their foot to their mouth or eyes or whatever, but, it was one of those things that, it's sort of one of those duh experiences that we had when we put like weeks and months into seeing whether we could get babies to get toys on their feet when we realized, we can, but then when they do, it's sort of the end of the conversation in a way. I think there is something important about having toys close to your face, even for infants who are visually impaired, because they can then, find out more about the toy by putting it in their mouth or something like that. So we're sort of thinking about, kind of the functional consequences of having, more contact or closer contact with the toy once you get it there. Yeah, Paul.
Thanks for your talk. I have a lot of questions, but I'll kind of shoot to the more interesting of these. So to what extent are you married to looking as your primary dependent variable, as opposed to generalized intentional reaching and without the mitten? For example, might the brain become more quickly able to control intentional reaching without the mitten, given a lot of experience in doing that through the sticky mitten treatment, so that after the sticky mitten is taken off, children continue to try to reach, touch, and explore things with their hands without the mitten? To what extent do we know about that, and how interested or disinterested are you in that?
Oh, yeah, I'm really interested in what the experience with the mittens might do for them when they don't have the mittens on. Absolutely. I'm also not tied to looking as the only thing that's interesting here. In one of our early studies using the mittens, one of the things we found was that the trained and the untrained groups of babies did about the same amount of swatting for toys that were near them, but the trained babies did more of what we called intentional swats, where they were looking at the toy and then they swatted. And the other babies were doing some of that, but they were also doing a lot of kind of getting the toy on their hand when they didn't kind of mean to, you know. So I think that, but, you know, those were with the mittens on, but we also find differences, like the differences that we found in that that four-phase looking, reaching thing, those were all without the mittens on. And so we do have evidence that their behavior without the mittens on is definitely influenced by what happens with when they do have the mittens on. And I think it's really important to do that, because we don't want to just sort of end up with the idea that these kids have learned this parlor trick that, you know, while I'm wearing these things, look at all the stuff that happens, and then I have them off and I'm, you know, that there's no carryover. We don't want that to, I mean, that might have been true. We have evidence that's not true, and I think that's really important, because we want to, you know, if we're going to do this intervention that will really matter for these infants who are visually impaired, we need to be sure that their hands are free for exploring stuff, and we don't want to have it be somehow tied to the mittens themselves. That would be not so good. Thank you so much. Thank you.